This is On Being's Unheard Cuts. I'm Krista Tippett. You're listening to my unedited conversation with anthropologist Helen Fisher. Download the MP3 of our produced show with her at onbeing.org.
Oh, well, over and over and over and over because of the clock. I mean, that's the biggest, my biggest problem.
It's the clock.
Always my biggest problem.
Yeah. It's understandable.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's like really big, blaring there, kind of haunting you.
I don't even look at it until the end, and I saw all those zeros. I said, oh, no.
Oh, God, yeah, you handled it very well. You're like, okay, just a couple more minutes, I'll be done.
Yeah.
No, it was great, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I had to do one of these TED All-Star talks, and I had 5 minutes. It took me 18 hours to write a five-minute speech.
Right, to get it down to 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, to find out, first of all, to think about what is the most important things, have a little bit of humor in there.
Yeah.
And do it in 5 minutes. It was such a nightmare.
Yeah.
But this was a nightmare, too. This one was a nightmare. It took me, I wrote that thing for 3 days.
Yeah.
Well, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's over.
Yeah.
Almost over.
Well, it's over. Yeah, you're going to be. I suspect you'll be giving that talk again, or versions of it.
Probably parts of it, but because it was about rebellion.
Yeah, so you shifted the lens a bit.
So I was trying to choose. And generally, there were some real wrong things in there. I dropped a bomb right in the beginning, but nobody knew it was a bomb, and I didn't explain it when I talked about monogamy and adultery going hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I proceeded to not tell anything about why I know this,
mm-hmm.
what it is,
yeah, it's true.
Where it evolved,
yeah.
where we're going with it, anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, as a writer,
yeah.
it was. But I wanted to tell that beginning story.
But in terms of the experience of the listener, so much happened in the next half hour after that that nobody was saying, oh, gee, what happened there? Yeah, I mean, it was there, as in it was kind of in the mix of what you got out of it.
Right.
Yeah.
But you'd have to design these things, and it was, but I worked and worked and worked and worked and worked on it. Yeah. Anyway, bottom line is these things take time.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I want to have, I've read your books and also read interviews other people have done of you. So, you know, really dug around to try to get as three-dimensional view as I could. And I think I want to ask you some questions or, like, push, you know, take the conversation in some directions that I haven't seen other people go with you. And you may want to go there or not. We'll see.
I don't have any.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I'll do my best.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Can we stop and start, or does this?
Yeah. Totally. No. This is completely real conversation, and if you know, it doesn't have to be linear. You know, we have to edit it down afterwards. Anyway.
You do edit it down.
But we edit it. I mean, you don't have to worry about some people who've been interviewed a lot and edited even try to help you, but don't help us. Just you can start and stop and start over, and it'll be our job.
I get excited. I start to try to lean forward a bit, I should just stay here no matter what.
No, I want you to be able to move.
Yeah.
So we can move the mic if you.
Can back this off a little bit?
I guess.
Pretend you're excited.
Oh well, you know. I mean, I'd be all over the place.
Yeah.
So I'll just do my best to just.
Okay.
The mics are pretty good and sensitive, and you shouldn't need to worry about it. If you go way off mic, somehow Chris will tell you. Right.
Okay. Well, I'll keep my eye on.
Yeah.
What
and
doing.
This is also not like.
Real far in toward her.
I won't do anything. The other thing is that this chair is so steep
I'm
very comfortable. My back is very comfortable right where it is. So I'll do my very best to not move around.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your interest.
Well, I think this whole subject of love and the complication of it and how it's so... how it's everywhere in our lives and in our culture, but we don't have much of a handle on it.
Right.
It has been something that we've been talking about wanting to kind of try to get into from some different directions. And so I got, you know, really excited about your work. And I do have a question. I did not ask it yesterday on stage because that was such a focused discussion, but I always ask whoever I'm speaking with, if there was a religious or spiritual background to their childhood, like however you might define that.
Mm-hmm. None.
None, really?
I had no religious education at all. Mm-hmm. I grew up in an entirely lily white Christian community in Connecticut. And when it came time for Sunday school, my father said to me and to my twin sister, I'd be happy to take you to the church on my way to play tennis, but you're going to have to find your own ride home.
Okay.
And so I went once and got a ride home with Margot Eberman's family, which we lived nearby, and that was it. Mm-hmm. The rest of my Sundays were spent playing with my twin sister, and I never went again. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm interested in religion. I'm an anthropologist.
Yeah.
And I'm actually going to a church right now up in Harlem. And I originally went for the gospel music, but this particular preacher actually says something. I'd like to have an experience in which I come home thinking about something. This is one of the reasons that I love the theater, particularly people like Ibsen, because you come away from it with ideas about yourself, ideas about the world. And if Christianity or any of the other religions, you know, provided those interesting ideas or insights into self, then I'm not opposed to it.
Yeah.
I happen to be an atheist, mm-hmm. And I always have been. I mean, I don't know if you've ever looked at the Hubble telescope site, the Hubble site on the internet.
Yes.
But when you take a look at what's out there, It's so staggering. Reality is so staggering that I don't need to construct any other meanings to it. Hmm. The real meanings of life for me are in reality, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't want to insult anybody. And
No, I don't think that is insulting. I think it's your...
In fact, my twin sister lives in France, and her French friends are astonished that we never had any religious education as children. And in fact, it was never discussed in my house. It wasn't one of those things that was discussed.
I think that is kind of unusual.
Yeah, it is.
Growing up in America.
Yeah, I grew up in a glass house built by Elliot Noyes right next to Philip Johnson's glass house. And perhaps my parents were iconoclasts of some variety. I don't have any idea. So I never talked about it with them.
Yeah.
But I never saw my father in a church once. Hmm. And when it came to be time to be confirmed into the Christian church, I remember everybody else in my town went, and I did not. And so my mother took me to the Congregational Church, which we were apparently a part of. And I just remember saying to him, well, you know, you always talk about Jesus Christ, but you never talk about God. And that was a much more interesting concept to me than a messenger. And I actually think all of the world's religions have some wonderful parts to them. I mean, the Christians have the art. There's no Caravaggio, Tintoretto in any other religion. They've got the art and wonderful ritual. I think the Jews have beautiful music, wonderful music. And I think they have wonderful ideas.
Right, Rosh Hashanah, a wonderful intellectual tradition.
Yes, and in fact, I have a Jewish girlfriend, and I'm just begging her to allow me to come in. I've gone to my second Rosh Hashanah now. And I mean, you know, this idea of,
of
thinking about your sins and apologizing to people is wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I think in the Islamic Muslim, I love the idea of Ramadan. The idea of not eating or drinking anything all day long for a month must bring these people together so much after sunset. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something about going through a hardship or rituals together is something that I think is a very valuable idea.
And I think that's definitely the anthropologist in you.
Yeah, and I think the Buddhists have the, you know, I was in Tibet a couple years ago, and they've got an awful lot of fish in those streams. And it's because nobody wants to kill a fish. Yeah. And so if they're going to kill something, they want to kill something big so a lot of people can eat, as opposed to a little thing. So you're taking one soul for only one meal, as opposed to if you kill a yak or a large animal, you can feed a lot of people for several days and only kill one soul. So there's wonderful things about all the religions. And I certainly am hoping that, you know, I lived with the Navajo for a while, many years ago. And, of course, their real belief in the earth.
Oh, you lived with the Navajo community somewhere?
I lived, it was 1968, and I was sent by the Museum of Natural History in New York to study a matrilineal society. And they're matrilineal. They trace their descent through mother as opposed to father. And so I was sent out as a young girl. And, you know, their main god is a woman, and they have a great respect for the earth.
And so if I could create a religion, I would pick some from all of them and put them together into a new one. Mm. It's maybe time for that too.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one of those. You talk a lot in your work about how we are kind of reversing 10,000 years of habit. And we're doing that in many spheres. And I think religion is not going to look the same in the next century.
That's a wonderful way to. I had not thought about that. Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. How do you think it will look?
I don't know. But, the thing about religious identity is, I mean, your story is pretty unusual for a couple of generations ago, but it's not very unusual for kids being raised now.
Right.
And I think religious identity, and I mean, this plays into your work where people married people often of the same religious and ethnic group, right? But that identity that was conferred upon us almost like hair color and, you know, the neighborhood we lived in, it wasn't just the religion we belonged to, but maybe the church or the synagogue that our parents and grandparents had gone to, but that's all falling away, right? So people are creating their spiritual lives
for themselves. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And
that's new in human history.
You know, most of human history has been shamanism. Mm-hmm. And in shamanism, of course, there is a great belief that in animism, you know, the fact that rocks and trees and plants and the sunset and everything has meaning. And maybe with the whole movement towards global warming, we're seeing a new emphasis on...
We start to pay attention to that again.
Maybe that will evolve into an old, but yet new, a return to a respect for all living things. Yeah. You know, one of the things, you know, I've written these books, and my favorite chapter in all of the books is a chapter about how animals love.
Really? That's your favorite?
Yeah, it's my favorite chapter. First of all, it's very easy to tell a story because there's wonderful stories about animals. Mm. But, you know, this brain circuitry for romantic love evolved, and it evolved from something.
Right.
And this basic brain system is very similar in all of the mammals and even some of the birds. And you can see animals act as if they're in love. Now, we use the word in love, but if you wanted to use the word animal attraction, or animal magnetism.
Right, which we used to talk about ourselves.
Yeah, and you can see a fox in the beginning of the mating season just lock his eyes on a particular female and then doggedly follow her and not eat and not sleep and snuggle up next to her and lick her constantly and bring her food even when he's really hungry and just be what looks like obsessed with her. And it was wonderful for me to tell these stories about... one of my favorite stories is about a black rhino, and he's displaying in front of a female. He's got this tiny little tail that's whizzing around, and he's pulling up the brush and he's getting up on his hind legs and strutting. And then I remember the woman who wrote about him saying, he looked for all the world as if he were dancing. And and so you see the continuity between man and beast,
right.
And you see animals have more life for me, and I'm trying to get the world to understand that these basic brain systems come from somewhere, and that other animals have these intense feelings.
What I like about that too, the way you're talking about it, is I think when we use phrases like what did you say?
Animal attraction.
When we use animal attraction, it's like something primitive and kind of base.
Yeah.
But you're talking about something that's joyful and playful as well as kind of hardwired and innate.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where do you trace really I'm just curious, can you trace the earliest origins of this, of love and romance and this drive in us as something that you had this special curiosity about that you started to pursue?
You know, people have always asked me why I study love. Mm-hmm. And this is in hindsight. I'm an identical twin. And long before I knew that there was a nature-nurture controversy, I was very busy trying to measure how much of my own behavior was biological and how much of it was cultural. Mm-hmm. Because you can't be an identical twin without having everybody ask you, do you have the same friends? Do you have the same cavities in your teeth? Do you like the same food? Do you have extrasensory perception? And so I was very busy, even as a small child, trying to figure out what part of me came out of my biology
and what I had already learned from my environment. So when I got to graduate school, and as a child, I was very interested in people. I lived in this glass house.
Yeah, right.
And my neighbors lived in a glass house. And by the time I was 6 and 7, I would sneak into the woods and sit on an old stone wall and watch them eat dinner. Mm. I would just glued to the train when we took the train from Grand Central Station out to Connecticut. After a visit into New York, I would be glued to the window looking into the homes of people's, you know, when we would stop at 125th Street. So I've always been terribly interested in people, mm-hmm. and I've always been interested in why we're all alike as opposed to why we're all different. Mm-hmm. So when it came time for my PhD dissertation, what I was most interested in, I figured that if there was any part of us at all that we had all in common, it would be our reproductive strategies. It would be our sex lives, our romantic lives, and our reproductive lives. Because that's the way you pass your DNA on to
tomorrow.
Right,
that's how we continue to survive collectively.
So I would figure out, my base idea concept was, well, languages are going to be different. Food customs are going to be different. Courtship customs are probably going to be different. But your basic feelings of romance and partnership may all be the same. Huh. So it was rather of an intellectual. I got there through an intellectual path rather than having a bad love affair. I didn't have a bad love affair that drove me that direction, which is what I think a lot of people would assume.
Uh-huh. So, you know, when I was reading about your research and what you're learning, I thought about over the years, you know, as somebody who has been married and divorced and has thought a lot about, you know, but also, I don't know, you and I can talk openly here and we can edit it out. This probably will not be there. But, you know, I had a very lively, wonderful, rich life as a single person when I was younger and then got married. And I don't regret getting married. And I think that the person I married is absolutely I can't imagine having anybody else as father of my children. And that is his main role in my life now, right? And that's still a role in my life. But boy, when I look back at, what an intelligent person I was and how many rich and interesting relationships I had before I met him and the reasons I married him, which made no sense, you know? And one thinks about these things also right. as one. And then you see, I would say...
Timing plays a role.
Timing, right, exactly.
You know.
But I would say, you know, I think so many of us... who are single, but not just single people. I kind of look around the world today at the matter of love, and it feels like there's just a lot of disarray. Now, whether there's more disarray than there ever has been, who knows? You know, maybe we know all the stories too much. I mean, obviously,
I think it is a time
marriage
of disarray.
And divorce has been in flux. I was looking back. There was this passage in, but one of the things that was interesting to me about your science is, you know, you do describe what happens in the brain as it has hallmarks of temporary insanity, right? I mean,
right.
It's obsessiveness. I mean, I think
right.
you've said that is the chief hallmark of obsessiveness. I pulled out this passage from a novel, and I know you also like to work with literature and poetry. Julian Fellowes, who created Downton Abbey. But he wrote this novel, and I just loved this passage when I found it. He said, lust, that state commonly known as being in love, is a kind of madness. It is a distortion of reality so remarkable that it should, by rights, enable most of us to understand the other forms of enable most of us to understand the other forms of lunacy with the sympathy of fellow sufferers. And yet, as we all know, it is a madness that, however ferocious, seldom, if ever, lasts. But paradoxically, mad and suffering as one is in the heat of the flame, few of us are glad as we feel that passion slip away. You know, he goes on. While most people have been at their unhappiest when in love, it is nevertheless the state the human being yearns for above all.
Yeah. I don't know. I think it was Samuel Johnson. You know, he described remarriage as the triumph of hope over experience.
Yes. Yes.
We do it over and over and over right. again. I mean, it is so powerful and it is such a distortion of reality. You know, in fact, parts of the brain associated with decision making begin to shut down when you're in love.
Okay, literally, and that makes so much sense.
Yeah, the blood rolls out instead of rolling in, and so they begins to shut down. And of course, I mean, for obvious reasons, I mean, this brain system of romantic love, and I do think it's different from lust. I do think they're very different brain systems.
Right.
Romantic love evolved for that reason, to enable you to overlook everything in order to be with this human being. And of course, that's what you really need to do to start that mating process. Mm-hmm. Because bottom line is, you know, if you have four children and I have no children, you live on and I die out. You know, the game of love matters. It matters big time. It, you know, it enables you to send your DNA on into tomorrow. And so we've evolved a brain system. Mm-hmm. And attachment's a very strong brain system too, but it's not as the same quite insanity. Mm-hmm. Maybe a different form of insanity. But, you know, it evolved to be so strong that some people will leave their community, they'll leave their town, they'll leave their family, they'll go to a different country, they'll learn a new language, they will start all over with their lives to do this thing. And then you wake up a few years later, you know, and, you know, in my books I've had to wonder, people wonder why that early state of intense romantic passion begins to die. Mm-hmm. And bottom line is, it takes a lot of metabolic energy. You don't eat, you don't sleep, you don't think about anything else. You focus on this person constantly. You change your hair, you change your life, you change your clothes, you change your friends. You do a million different things in order to win and be part of this relationship. And you can't tolerate that forever. Not only will you run out of energy, but you can't really have a child sitting there at dinner and the two of you racing around the dinner table after each other.
Right. Well, right. So that's what I think, you know, and you have described all of this and what's happening in the brain in terms of this brew of neurotransmitters and hormones.
Brew's a wonderful word.
So interesting.
Never heard that. Mm-hmm.
And yet, right, but you describe it as, you know, all these lines get blurred, but there are these, but those qualities that make for that coming together with that other person in this intense way and deciding to rearrange the rest of your life to be with them, as you say, in order, there are these drives in us.
It's a drive.
To have that, and that in evolutionary terms, it had everything to do with having those children. But then it's a whole different set of qualities that we need to have, that we need to be manifesting personally and also in that relationship in order to actually be good parents, right?
That's exactly. And that's one of the reasons that I say to people, you know, don't marry him or her until some of that intensity is worn off.
Really?
So that you really know more about who you're going to have a partnership with. It's very interesting because I now study personality, and I read an article not long ago about the fact that you really actually don't get to know somebody very well until about 18 months are over. Mm-hmm. And of course, if it's in a good relationship, you keep learning things about them 30 years later. I mean, when their parents die, if a child dies, if you suddenly have to move or you lose all your money or you make a lot of money, you're going to learn a whole lot of new things about somebody. I think that's one of the problems with American marriage. We somehow think that, you know, the minute you marry, you sort of lock the door and stay in place. Whereas relationships evolve, and a good one is constantly evolving.
Yeah. And was it Margaret Mead who said everyone should have three marriages, even if it's to the same person?
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, like that everyone should have three marriages, and even if it's the same person, that the marriage has to become something new at a different stage in life.
Oh, that's wonderful. And I know that she said that the first one is for sex, the second one is for children, and the third one is for companionship.
Yeah.
And
But I mean, so what's so interesting, again, about the way you're able to break this down is this first part of it, this falling in love part of it, this passion, this madness, which then leads to this commitment, is just instinctive. It's not only built into us, it almost takes us over.
No question about it. It takes over the brain.
But then this other part about the part about raising children, the part about, you know, crafting a long-term love, moving into those next two marriages, if you want to use that analogy, we're so unprepared for.
Well, you know, this is why, you know, when you said we were in a time of disorganization.
Yeah.
And we are. I mean, we are shedding 10,000 years of our farming background and all of the concepts that arose with that. I mean, the fact that a woman's place is in the home, women don't have a head for business, men should be the head of the family, men should be the sole family provider, till death do us part. All of that is vanishing. In before our very eyes, 10,000 years of these concepts. And so we're at this time of disorganization where nobody knows really how to go forward.
Yeah.
And so it gives us great opportunities to build the kinds of partnerships that we really want. And one of the beautiful things about, you know, what you just said is that, okay, well, we don't really know how to parent. And we don't really know much about this person. And so what we're doing now is getting into relationships very slowly.
Right.
And that's the beauty of this.
And that's a shift that you're seeing now.
Yeah. These one-night stands, the friends with benefits,
yeah.
the living together before you getting married.
Yeah.
More and more people are having children before they marry.
Yeah.
And so they are beginning to, they're beginning to really understand a human being
mm-hmm.
before they sink the boat. You know, into
I think it's important to dwell on that because what you are saying is that, you know, especially generationally, you can, and I, you know, I have children who are 16 and 20, right? And you can say,
boys, girls,
16-year-old boy, 20-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, she just turned 21. And you can worry, but parents can worry about, as you say, the casual sex, the friends with benefits, which feels just really suspect and, you know, irresponsible right. and scary.
Right.
But you're saying that that's not necessarily about them being flaky or casual, but it's a manifestation of being cautious. And
not only being cautious, really learning something about this person. Now, I mean, most people know all about contraception, so that worry should be no longer with us.
Yeah.
And most people know about disease, and so that they should be able to monitor that.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the riskiest parts of living with somebody are gone. And of course, you know, parents are now accepting their children living with somebody, so mm-hmm. they don't even have the social stigma of it.
Mm-hmm.
And their social circles are accepting it. So a lot of people, you know, almost intuitively reason, I've got no reason to not do this, and I got huge reasons to really get to know this person.
Well, and especially when so many people now are growing up in homes where marriages failed.
Exactly. And they've seen it around them.
Not just them, but all right. their friend groups. I mean, I think my kids. And then there's this interesting thing that's happening now with the fluidity of family of, you know, all the forms of family.
Right.
I mean, there is no model,
right?
You know,
we're seeing a new form called that I call the association,
mm-hmm.
and I'm really excited about it because it's groups of friends. And I live in New York. My both parents are deceased. My older sister lives in Europe. My brother's dead, and my twin sister lives in Europe. So mm-hmm. I really, Thanksgiving is a challenge for me,
mm-hmm.
and I'm between men, so that's a real challenge. And so I have a group of friends who I see,
mm-hmm.
And I see them regularly. And they're the ones that'll come to the hospital if I'm sick. They're the ones that I will call to say that I made a speech that people liked. And it's an association of friends.
Yeah,
that is my real family. And it's interesting how a lot of young people have their association. They're much closer to their association than they are to their own family. So Christmas and holidays become very stressful for them
mm-hmm.
because they go home to families that they really don't know very well and who don't really know them. They don't know what to give their aunt for Christmas or Hanukkah or whatever because they don't know these people the way they know the people they hang around with in New York City. So we're building new forms of family.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder if you've also paid any attention to something I'm aware of as a parent of teenage children and I hear a lot of people talking about is that even this romance piece seems to happen collectively in groups.
Yeah.
You know, dating is not what it used to be.
Right.
You don't invite the girl to go to a movie and dinner. Right. You go out with a group of friends and then somehow people are coupled, but it's a very different pattern.
And even that I think is cautious.
Yeah.
Not, I mean, first of all, they don't have a lot of money and dinner mm-hmm. these days costs a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start having dinner with somebody, you are expressing a genuine interest. Yeah. But if you casually go out with a group and you go all dancing and then you all end up having breakfast at 2 a.m. in some place and you can get to know somebody, it's the expanding pre-commitment stage. Uh-huh. And there is, I think, a Darwinian wisdom to that. It's interesting. I was talking to somebody recently who said that actually the dinner date is coming back.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen the signs of that.
No.
Even among older people. I mean, you know, I'm older. And I'm forming new friendships in a group. And that's exactly what's happening to me. There's a couple men in that group that I could be interested in, but mm-hmm. nobody's expressed anything. Everybody
and
just
you don't
goes
know
with
what
the group.
The rules of the game are, because it's a new game, right?
It's a new game.
Yes.
Everybody has to make up their own rules, yes. which is both extremely difficult, but has great opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think we're seeing a whole lot of new, I mean, for example, with technology, I mean, that is changing courtship. It's not changing love. I mean, once you, whether you meet them on Tinder or Facebook or Match.com or your girlfriend sets you up, mm-hmm. when you meet that person in the bar or at the coffee house, your ancient human brain clicks into action and you court the way we've done it for millions of years. But bottom line is that courtship, you know, how you meet somebody, what the etiquette is, we're now building what Margaret Mead called taboos. Instead of rules, taboos. One of the new taboos is that 60% of people on a date find it extremely rude if their partner, dating partner, pulls out
their phone.
And does a text message or uses their phone in any way. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I do this annual study with Match.com called mm-hmm. Singles in America. Mm-hmm. And we don't poll the Match population. We poll the American population. Mm-hmm. It's based on the U.S. Census. And we're very interested in how technology is changing things. So we, at Match, we really watch, you know, what is Tinder doing? And, you know, what is Instagram doing? And how do you use these? And how often do you research a date? And 45% of women research a date before they go out. About 33% of men do, far fewer men. Mm-hmm. We don't know why.
Really?
But my hypothesis is that men are much more afraid of being accused of stalking. And so they're not going to do that. But what amazes me as an anthropologist is why doesn't 100% of both men and women research the date?
Yeah.
Because it's natural. I mean, for millions of years, we lived in these little hunting and gathering groups, and they would arrive at a water hole, and some girl would see some cute boy at the other side of the water hole, and she didn't know him.
She'd ask someone about it.
Her mother knew his aunt.
Yeah.
Her father knew his brother.
Yeah.
She knew what he was going to be when he grew up. She probably knew what his religion was. She probably even knew whether he was a good shot or whether he had a good sense of humor. People for millions of years went into relationships, even on the first date, knowing a good deal about a human being.
Okay.
And we somehow think that it's natural to walk into a bar and know nothing about somebody and unnatural to go onto a dating site, where in fact it really is the reverse.
That's making me think of something I've been hearing about recently that that colleges, when they place roommates,
uh-huh.
Many of them have stopped giving kids the name of their roommate before they arrive on campus.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Because people were researching to death who their roommate was going to be and deciding they didn't want to live with this person and not giving them a chance. And so they had all this bureaucracy around changing the roommate pool.
That's very interesting.
What makes you think about, you know, the old-fashioned value of encountering another human being in the flesh first.
Right.
And, you know, the colleges know that once the kids have met and do know their name, they will then go Google them.
Right.
But it's interesting for you to point out that even before there was an internet and you could do a search, there were ways to do a search.
Oh, big time.
Yeah.
And now we're sort of on our own. In the past, mm-hmm. our parents.
Right. We don't
you
have
know,
those extended
we don't
circles
have any
of
those
who
extended,
know them.
You know, and we are missing something. You know, the loss of local community. Everybody's very upset about divorce. Divorce has been around for a good 4 million years. Serial pair bonding is probably basic to the human animal. Series of partnerships. Mm-hmm. But what is really unusual for me is the loss of local community. Mm-hmm. We have extended communities. We have our internet friends. We've got our work friends. We've got our people who we exercise with. We've got people who we go to a poetry conference with, whatever it is. But we don't have local community.
Well, and The other thing I've thought about some over the years is how marriages are such lonely. You know, the nuclear family
right.
is very unnatural in human history for these same reasons, right? That marriages and families would have been embedded in networks of other marriages and other families and elders and cross-generational.
So well said. So well said.
And I think it is this... It's like this death blow to marriage as an institution almost to have it be this isolated.
Right.
Where, you have two people who
right.
are left to take everything out on themselves.
You know, people are so upset about a single mother or a single father.
Yeah.
I'm upset, like you are, about the two of them.
Yeah.
They're all by themselves.
Yes.
And it's so interesting. You know, I have a housekeeper who comes every 2 weeks to move the dust around. And I just adore this woman. And she's from Ecuador. And I asked her how many, people she has for Thanksgiving. She has 50 people for Thanksgiving. I couldn't scare up 10 relatives. I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And so, there certainly are whole worlds that perhaps you and certainly me are not living in. Mm-hmm. But I think our way is the future that, that there could be more and more
choose,
isolated
like,
people.
Chosen families also, this association is the
right.
antidote that we're...
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
To rebuild local community.
Yes.
But, there's something beautiful about... And that's, of course, the way we live for millions of years. So, 100,000 years ago, if you divorced, okay, so he walked out of the little camp with his bow and arrow, and that was it.
Right.
But you still had your mother, your aunts, your uncles, your cousins,
yeah.
a whole pile of people to support your child
yeah, right.
with you.
Right, right.
You had a whole local community, and
right.
that's what's really disappearing. And
right,
I think we will see
this whole idea that a single mother is a new invention.
There were single mothers in hunting and gathering societies, but they were embedded.
Right, yeah.
And that's the difference.
Yeah.
And that is a real mm-hmm. shame. And the other thing is that, these days you'll see a woman have children. Now, your children are 4 years apart.
Yeah.
That's the natural human birth spacing.
Is it?
Is 4 years apart.
It works really well.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's unusual.
Because you have one child who's out of diapers and is off in playgroups
mm-hmm.
when you're dealing with the baby. And mm-hmm. that's, when you look in hunting and gathering societies, they tend to have their children 4 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so the one child has joined what they call a multi-age play group and can be raised by all kinds of other people in the band that it's no longer nursing. And you can spend your time on the infant. And, with now the ability to have one child after another, you'll see people who sort of want to get their childbearing over with, and they'll have a six-month-old and a two-year-old and only one partner or maybe no partners.
Yeah.
That's the human animal wasn't built to do that.
Right. I mean, it is almost, it's physically overwhelming, apart from anything
emotionally,
else.
Physically,
yeah.
The exhaustion.
Yeah.
And so it's part of this age of tremendous transition.
Uh-huh. And, when you, so one of the things I feel comes through in your TED Talks and in this presentation I saw you give yesterday is, that this drive in us to mate and settle down is just one of the most fundamental things about who we are. I mean, logistically that it has kept our species going, but that it is so defining. But when you talk about these new associations, whatever stage of life we're at, and maybe with or without a romantic partner, of course, I think. I don't know if this is a true statement, but I think most of us, at any given time, if we had a choice, would you have a romantic sexual relationship, or not, you'd say sure.
Right.
But it's also possible to have, not to be lonely.
Right.
Without that.
Right.
And to have very rich lives that are full of love.
Absolutely.
Not that particular form of love,
right.
but full of love, which doesn't have insanity attached, which can be
exactly.
kind of a relief.
And you don't have to be annoyed if they leave their socks
right.
on the floor one more time.
Yeah.
Do
you think this is also, is this kind of a form of progress that we're charting, this new way of choosing our lives of love and association?
I like, it's a wonderful idea. The only thing I would disagree with is I'm not sure it's new. Maybe the association part is new because it was always family.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we've always had the opportunity until we began to settle down on the farm for millions of years in these little hunting and gathering groups, women really could make a lot of choices because women worked. Women commuted to work to gather their fruits and vegetables. They came home with often 60 to 80% of the evening meal, often the only meal. Women were just as economically and socially and sexually powerful as men. Mm. And in those kinds of societies where both sexes are powerful and relatively autonomous, you can make the kinds of relationships you want and you can walk out of bad relationships. Mm. And in that kind of, there's some beauty in those, that opportunity for choice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you're getting at. We're moving back into a world where people can make choices. Mm-hmm. And I would guess in hunting and gathering societies, there are older women who say, no, I'm not going for another old man. I'm going to hang around with the group and have a good time with my girlfriends.
Right.
And we're back at that. Whereas on the farm, they often married the next day after a partner died because they needed somebody to milk the
cows. It's so interesting to have that big, broad lens, that perspective.
Yeah, sometimes I look at some academics who don't have that lens, and I do think that their work is crippled by that lack of the deeper view.
Well, I remember even learning that 100 years ago, or up until the late 19th, early 20th century, was it something like the average marriage lasted for 7 years? Because lifespans were so different. We could all hang on for 7 years. right? Almost, no matter the marriage.
Right. That's interesting that you know that. Very few people know that. The lifespan, by the way, has never changed. But the bottom line is so many people died in infancy and childhood that the average was reduced. So if you made it through infancy, childhood, and adolescence, you were likely, even a million years ago, to live probably into your early 70s. Mm. That's what anthropologists who do life history charts think. But what did you say, though? It was so interesting. Oh, yeah. I in one of my books I had read and I wrote down that in the year 1900, the average marriage, I think, was 12 years.
12, yeah.
And in the year 1990, the average marriage was also 12 years. But in 100 years ago, the marriage ended because somebody died.
Mm-hmm.
And these days, it ends because somebody divorces.
Mm-hmm.
And in many respects, it's much better to have somebody who divorces because at least you may have somebody who helps with the children some of the time.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Although there's all this sense of failure.
Exactly.
And also
And if you didn't like them, they're still
because
around.
Because we don't know how to do it. We don't know how to do that, right? There's so much children get
hurt,
and
that's the biggest problem I think.
Yeah,
today is children. It's called the marriage go round, and you know, in hunting and gathering societies, women did tend to have two or three husbands during the course of their life. So there's nothing really new about divorce. But as we were saying, it's a lack of local community to support the child.
Yeah.
And these days, children really
there they
suffer.
Are between the two warring parents.
Exactly, and no others. Net.
Yeah.
You know, perhaps a grandmother or father, grandfather. But that's our biggest issue, I think, in our modern world is the children who children need support and they need stability. Mm-hmm. They need, more than anything, they need stability. They need somebody who's going to love them unconditionally and just plain old be around.
Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. So between, 1900 and 1990?
Yeah.
There was the 50s.
There was the 50s.
We lived through some wars. We were all living longer. We kind of enshrined this idea that we'd figured out how to live. You know, we knew what society looked like in neighborhoods and families. And there were long marriages. I mean, there still are long marriages.
Oh, yeah.
But there was this, there came to be what I don't think we really at all understand was a completely new idea that you would settle down and marry and be married forever.
Right.
That
really emerged 10,000 years ago with settling down on the farm.
Settling down on the farm.
Yeah. With that, you see the, excuse me, with the settling down on the farm, you begin to see people marrying very young, mm-hmm. and the concept of till death do us part, mm-hmm. because on the farm you need two individuals plus the children plus the grandparents and everything to do the land, mm-hmm. to farm the land, and you really can't walk out. Where are you going to go with a metric ton, 100 tons of what, of wheat or corn? You can't move. You can't cut the cow in half. Mm-hmm. You can't take half the wheat fields and move them out of town. Mm-hmm. You either stick it out, or you leave empty-handed. Mm-hmm. And so, with the beginning of farm living, you see this concept of till death do us part. They really had to stay together, and you also see a real difference in the balance of power between men and women. Suddenly, men moved the rocks, they felled the trees, they plowed the land. They were the ones that brought the produce off to local markets, and those are the ones they came home with the equivalent of money. And women could no longer hunt and, you know, gather their fruits and vegetables and come home with much of the evening meal. They were now relegated to the secondary jobs of picking, weeding, pruning, preparing the evening meal, right. and having lots of babies to work the land. And so right. you see really across hunting and gathering societies, everything from Europe through Asia, the rise of the double standard, the belief that women were less sexual than men, less economically powerful, not as smart, their place was in the home, et cetera. So along with settling down on the farm, and it had such a dramatic change into all of these modern beliefs.
So I'm becoming aware as we're speaking very kind of transactionally and biologically about the institution of marriage and you know what so this idea that we spoke about a minute ago of the damage that gets done to children when right. marriages fail the way they fail these days is significant, and those are the kinds of things that religious people talk about in sacred terms. I mean it is, you know, thinking about marriage as an institution that is there to be nurturing and in particular to be nurturing to the children. And there's all this, like the religious view of marriage as a sacrament it doesn't really figure in the way you study marriage and look at marriage. And I wonder if you ever have conversations with religious people.
It would be very interesting.
But have you not? Do people?
They haven't yet, but maybe you'll inspire them.
Yeah, I mean, because how would you? Do you see that as just as a way of thinking about marriage that is just completely removed from what you see and work with? Or
no, I see it as a beautiful.
What would an interesting discussion be for you?
Well, just backing up. Hold that thought, because that's something I really have to think about, what an interesting discussion would be.
Yeah.
But I think you've started it right now. And most religions, I don't see it as religion supporting marriage. I see the profoundly basic human drive to love and form marriages as so important that we've created institutions like religion to support it. Mm-hmm. So even more important than religion are these profoundly basic human drives to love. Mm. And religions then build on that drive to support that drive. Mm-hmm. So...
And in a way, maybe to settle it. I mean, maybe they're the religions
some rules.
Are in that gap that we talked about between the insanity of the falling and then the responsibility of the settling,
and to give people support.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, the concept of God is really a beautiful concept. It helps a great many people, in times of real stress and despair. It's one of mankind's great institutions, I would say, for both good and evil. I mean, you really see people killing each other over the concept, too. Mm-hmm. But it's one of mankind's institutions that is very supportive of love. Mm-hmm. So what kind of conversation would I like to have with a theologian? Can you tell me?
Well, I think maybe someone would say that they... that they are disturbed by how this, you know, this capacity that we have, I mean, not just restricted to romantic love, but including that, is just one of the most ennobling and defining characteristics of what it means to be human at its best. And I think,
and they, I would agree, of course,
right. And when I think they might be disturbed that you're that the scientific focus that you bring to it, the you know, that it might feel reductionistic. What happens in terms of neurotransmitters and hormones and biology? And I mean, I wonder how you would engage that discomfort.
You've just enabled me to say what if I when I die. What I'm going to say next is, for me, the one thing I would like humanity to remember. And that is, the more we know about the brain, the body, human evolution, about biology, the more we are will come to understand the power of culture to change that biology. Mm. Biology and culture and religion, they all go hand in hand. They're all parts of a huge, big system called humanity. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel that they threaten each other. I feel that they enhance one another. Mm-hmm. And that a truly religious person, if they have any imagination, can benefit from understanding that the love of God is in all of us in some form, that is biologically based. It's not going away. And that is part of humanity. So I don't see a big dichotomy that other people might see. I see a tremendous union between the intellectual, the spiritual, and the biological. I think they work together as a team.
That's great. Sometimes I worry that when you know, your vision of how we are completely overcoming 10,000 years and we're going back to a place where we choose, where we're not assigned partners, either, you know, overtly by being in an arranged marriage or just being in, you know, just with the expectations that come with who we will marry. Over the years, I've had friends and acquaintances who come from societies, India mostly, where they themselves or family members had been in arranged marriages.
Right.
And I came to this real respect for what I heard. You know,
right.
I heard so much that that your mate is selected for you, but that the love follows the marriage.
Right.
And often that it was very deep love,
right,
and a successful marriage.
Right.
And then I've contrasted that with this, you know, this crazy freedom we have to just, you know, and as you said, it's timing. I mean, it may not be that. The only thing that may line up in the person someone marries is the state they were in when that person came across their path,
right.
And how their biological clock was ticking at that moment. And so I've wondered, have you studied arranged marriages?
I have. And I read a book many years ago. I still have the book. I think it was even written in, I don't know, 50s or 60s. And it was called Marriage East and West. And it finally, truly explained it to me, because Americans as a group cannot understand arranged marriages. We have a visceral response.
It's like a form of torture.
Yeah, to arranged marriages. Yeah. And this really explained it in the most beautiful way. And it was a book, and it largely talked about India. And basically in India, they really do believe that their parents are going to pick the right person. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking forward to the marriage with the right person that their parents are going to choose. And of course, these days they can meet the person themselves and several times and say yes or no. So there's no place in the world anymore where the children are forced into a marriage.
Yeah.
But to my knowledge. But anyway, the bottom line is, in these arranged marriages, these children are really looking forward, believing that their parents are going to find them the right person. And then the marriage in India is very fancy. It goes on for many days. You're all dressed up. And when you get all dressed up, and it's all that
so
music
all
and
all that
ritual, dancing.
That ritual thing that humans need.
All that's going to drive up the dopamine in the brain.
Okay.
And the dopamine is going to light up that brain circuitry for romantic love. And it's my understanding that in India, they even have a word that during the series of marriage ceremonies, romantic love will enter.
Huh.
And of course, they've created all these rituals so that romantic love will enter. Any kind of novelty drives up the dopamine system in the brain, mm-hmm. and can trigger the brain circuitry for romantic love. So they not only believe that mother and dad will pick the right person. And in fact, one of the lines in the book, it was something like, we can't believe how you Americans have to get all dolled up and sit around in a bar and wait for people to call. And, well, we just sit around and play with our girlfriends and dad finds us the perfect boy. And you begin to see the logic of this. And one of the problems in India, though, is that it's very hard to divorce.
Yeah.
And so,
if the love doesn't work out,
there's something called these dowry deaths, mm-hmm. in which the women are constantly cooking, mm-hmm. and she gets burned alive.
Yeah.
And this is not good.
I mean, another thing from your science that I was applying to that is you talked about how casual sex doesn't really remain casual.
It's not casual. Unless you're so drunk you can't remember.
And why? I mean, how you can explain it. It's because of what is set off in your brain and your body conspires to make you start feeling attached to this person.
Or in love. Or both.
Or in love, yeah.
Right.
And then I thought also in terms of arranged marriage when they say, you know, so this is interesting. So it starts with the ritual that starts amping up these
brain circuitry.
Imitating what would happen if you met the one and knew it across the room, right? And then the marriage is consummated, I would think.
Sure.
Which also begins to
absolutely
trigger
those
attachment.
Systems. That's exactly right. And, you know, I mean, when you have an orgasm, you get a real flood of oxytocin and vasopressin, and these are the basic bodily and brain systems for attachment.
Right. It's like what mothers get when they love their babies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, don't have sex with somebody you don't want to feel something for.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, people can do what they want to do. I'm not in the should business. But the bottom line is, if you don't want to get attached to somebody, it's easier to not sleep with them.
Right.
Because you might end up being attached to somebody who really does not fit into your life.
And I think in this new world, I mean, I grew up in a very conservative, strict Southern Baptist, you know, small town where you were saving yourself for marriage. You know?
Right.
Like, and this was just an absolute.
Right.
And you know, now I kind of look back on that and see it as helpful in a way. Like, mm-hmm. it provided boundaries that were good so that you didn't. I mean, I actually see these rules at a point. They didn't work very well, and they don't work any now at all in most places. But the provision of those boundaries so that you don't, when you're too young, to be swept away by that attachment.
Human animal needs boundaries.
It's so,
and that is one of the things. It's so interesting because apparently, a lot of these people who live in really bad neighborhoods, and the young men form gangs.
Yeah.
And apparently one of the reasons that they form gangs is these gangs have very rigid rules.
Yeah.
And they all grew up in families with no rules. Mother wasn't around. Dad wasn't around. People were taking drugs with no rules. And so they go into the gangs to find a home where there are rules.
Yeah.
And here we are in a society now where we don't have any rules.
Right.
Nobody knows what to do.
Right.
I mean, I see a man walking with me towards a door, and I also see him sort of step back. He doesn't know whether to open the door for me, thinking I might be insulted if he opens the door, or rush to open the door because I'm more traditional.
Yeah.
Nobody knows what to do.
I know, and it's so sad. I want them to rush to open the door.
I want a boy to be a boy.
That's right.
There's something basic about protection and sensitivity. I'm with you there.
And manners. Again, it's rituals, right?
Yeah.
It's rituals.
You know, one of the things is the divorce rate in America is highest in the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
And it's highest in the Bible Belt, probably not because of religion, but because they marry so young. And they marry so young because they're saving themselves for marriage.
Yeah.
And so it's not their religious beliefs, it's that they end up marrying so young mm-hmm. that they marry somebody that they mature and they turn into a sort of a fuller human being and yeah. realize that this isn't right for them.
Right. And even in very religious cultures like that, where people are kind of crafting their path towards marriage with these religious rules,
yeah.
I still think all the messages that are coming at them about who you marry and about the romance of that are coming from movies with happy endings
yeah.
and, you know, all the love songs that yeah. we just, you know, that just were awash in
right.
at that age. And I wanted to ask yeah. you about that because I guess one of my kind of deeper concerns here within this subject is that somehow, I mean, I love your idea that, you know, this knowledge is power, and somehow our brains take us through these several very powerful stages to getting to the point of being with other people. But somehow we need to figure out how to be intelligent and caring in this matter of long-term love. And it
right.
seems like we have almost, it seems like our brains don't do that for
it's
us.
It's such a good point because, you know, Americans love romantic love.
Yeah.
We just love romantic love.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't pay much attention to attachment.
No.
And it's very interesting. I was on some radio with a guy from China. And it was a great learning moment for me because I was talking about romantic love and how it's you can remain in love long term as well as loving the person, and you can sustain this long term romantic love in a deep attachment. And he said, "Why would you want to do that?"
Right.
Because they admire attachment. You know, or at least he did, and he was representing
right.
the Chinese
right.
perspective that, okay, romantic love comes and romantic love goes. What's really powerfully important is that feeling of deep attachment to
yeah.
a human being.
Yeah.
And at that moment, I said, oh, right, Helen, you've just been a member of your own culture and you've not realized that other cultures, historically,
the attachment itself is a wonderful thing.
that's what he was telling me.
Yeah.
And we celebrate romantic love and we do not really celebrate attachment. And in fact, you know, I remember a line from a poem that a friend of mine wrote, and which was, "We are lied to by our love songs."
Yes,
because
yes,
they always end up with a happy ending.
Yeah,
and you know, it's interesting. I in a documentary about my work that was done by a guy called Christian Frey, Frei, he's a Swiss guy, and it's called Sleepless in New York, and it's a documentary about rejection in love. And I'm the basic, it's a documentary, I'm the basic narrator, and then he has three people who've just gotten dumped. And it's a very powerful film. And it's airing all over Europe now.
Mm.
And he's a very well-known documentarian. He won Best Director for his last film, and he was nominated for an Oscar for a film before this. It's very well-known, and it's a very powerful film. And not one single American distributor has picked it up.
What is that about? We're so obsessed with...
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's because it's about rejection in love. And of course, you see these people come back to life.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a powerful mm-hmm. way of ending. But... what is it about Americans that, you know, we've been lied to by our love songs. We want to believe it. We do see it in the movies, a rejection.
Mm-hmm.
But we have rose-colored glasses on.
Yeah.
And I don't... that, or there's so much pain in the movie that people can't go there. I don't know what it is. I don't have a clue. But I find it fascinating statement about America, not yeah. about the movie.
I just also feel like... with all this change that we've talked about, with new up and coming generations, it being a complete matter of choice for them, right? And then the fact that we're all living longer.
Right.
I mean, we have so many decades potentially.
Yeah, to live
to
with
have,
somebody.
To be married, to have all kinds of relationships, or to have... a marriage that, you know, as Margaret Mead, you know, said, you know, might evolve to be a few marriages to survive. I just feel like somehow we have to grab hold of this and kind of become learners.
I think the young are.
You do?
I mean, yeah, in this Singles in America, not everybody, but in this Singles in America study that I do with Match.com, you know, we ask them, what must you have in a relationship and what's very important? And, you know, as I said last night, they must have somebody they can trust and confide in. They must have somebody who respects them. They must have somebody who makes them laugh, which actually is very important biologically.
I just love that.
Because laughter drives up the dopamine system. It's very good for you. Laughter is very good for you.
Yeah.
They must have somebody who spends enough time, gives them enough time, and they must have somebody that they find physically attractive. We are turning inwards. We are trying to build now the most important relationship. And when I ask the questions like, this is what singles refuse, do not... They're very in favor of marriage without children. They're very in favor of children without marriage. They're very in favor of living together. What they will not tolerate is commuter marriages, people living in separate homes, people living in separate bedrooms. They want total transparency in the relationship. They want to have access to the person's cell phone. That a great many of them would walk out even on a date who hides what they're saying on their phone or their texts. I think they're looking for a really special kind of relationship. You know, 100 years ago, sure, you had a nice husband and that was great, but you also had very profound relationships with all your other people in the local community.
Yeah.
And so the partnership didn't have the same profound intimacy, because it wasn't all you've got. Now your partner's really all you got.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want everything in that partnership. So
that's
rather than being less serious about that primary relationship, I think we are profoundly more serious about it. I think people are taking this very seriously. There's never been so many self-help books. There's never been so many therapists and couples therapists and all kinds of support systems.
So this education is maybe just, it's happening now. It's happening in real time.
They don't want to fail. They've seen their parents fail. Yeah. They've seen their friends fail. They're scared of divorce. You know, 67% of singles these days are terrified of the economic and the social and personal fallout from divorce. And we may see a real swing towards, you know, really good marriages. Well, you know, I did this study of married people with Match.com, not their Match population, of course. Mm-hmm. They're not married. And I asked these married people, it was 1,000 people in the study, a little over 1,000, would you remarry the person that you are married to now? And 81% said yes. So... and 76% said that they were still madly in love with this person. And I have friends who've done other similar studies and found the same data. So, you know, you're talking to an optimist. That's probably your problem.
but also, did I read that you were married once but briefly? Is that right?
I was only married for a few months when I was 23.
Yeah.
And... I married the wrong person.
Yeah.
And actually, the night we decided to divorce was one of our best nights together. And then, well, you know, I was a young hippie in graduate school.
Okay.
It was the 60s.
Okay. All right.
And we then went out together for another 4 years. But no, he wasn't the right guy for me.
Mm-hmm.
I have then made 2 very long. One was a 30-year relationship. He died about 5 years ago. Mm. We lived together for about 20 years, and then we lived separately, but I still spend every Christmas with him, every holiday with him. He's always been really the love of my life. And then I've also had for almost 18 years a relationship with another man. It was very powerful, 2 powerful relationships. So I don't feel... I would have married either of them. The first one, he said to me one night, he said,
I'd be happy to marry you, you know. Just let me know if that works for you.
Right.
And for some reason, I was young and didn't feel that I needed a marriage. I never wanted to have children. I think that's what's really important. Had I wanted to have children, mm-hmm. I've always felt that there were an awful lot of children in the world. I could do something else with my life that could mm-hmm. be more of use. Mm-hmm. And I was really obsessed with my work, and I didn't want to lay that on a child. And my twin sisters had a child, so, I felt that I feel that I've had two very powerful, deeply meaningful, and successful relationships. I mm-hmm. I didn't marry him, but there was true love.
Mm-hmm. So, how do you think all these things you know through your science, through your work? Yeah. You know, how have you been able to work with that, or have you? I mean, yeah. Is there a limit to, you know, when we talk about the insanity part of, yeah. of the reality of love?
Yeah. I use the I don't know if it's a metaphor or not, of a piece of chocolate cake. You can know every single ingredient in a piece of chocolate cake, but then when you sit down and eat it, you just feel that rush of joy. And in the same way, I know a lot about love. I know a lot about marriage. I know a lot about adultery and divorce. Know something about the brain. Now, certainly, hopefully, know something about evolution. But I'm just like you and everybody else. When it hits you, you're off to the races. You know, there's been times that I've walked towards the phone saying, "Don't call him, Helen. This isn't a good idea, Helen. Take control, Helen." Mm. As I'm punching the buttons on the phone and calling him. So, bottom line is, it has helped me, though. There's been times when I sort of met a man who I could have really loved and almost immediately found out that they loved somebody else. Mm-hmm. And I knew immediately, no, mm-hmm. don't go there. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if you don't know how powerful love is, you might try when, in fact, it's not the right idea. Mm-hmm. So knowing what I've known has helped me navigate. But the bottom line is I'm just like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any theories about or any perspective on it? It seems like the world right now, the world a lot of us inhabit, you know, Western, urban, educated people, is full of amazing single women.
Yeah.
And men, fewer men who are single. And even fewer men who are as amazing or as appropriate. It feels like the world is out of balance. Mm-hmm. I think, and again, I'm maybe talking about a certain demographic group, but it doesn't seem like it's just, you know, 40, 50, and 60 year olds. It seems like it's harder for 25 year olds to know where to look for a mate. So, what perspective do you have on that?
Well, first of all, I wrote a book about the natural talents of women and how they're changing the world.
Yeah.
And I would have written a book about men and their natural talents and how they're changing the world, but they've already done that. And we already know a lot of men's talents. And I think women have been the mysterious sex. And so I've written a whole book on gender differences in the brain and what we don't understand about women and the brilliance of women and what they really bring to the world. But I am also a big proponent of men. And I would say there's just as many amazing men out there as there are women in every age group. I don't think we understand men at all. Mm-hmm. You know, we've spent 50 years trying to bust a lot of myths about women.
About women, right.
And we've spent no years at all busting the myths about men.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of data with this Match.com Singles in America study that and other data too, but that men are just as romantic as women are. The brain is exactly the same.
But
in
is
terms
it true
of
that there are fewer single men? I mean, why
I don't
does
know.
That? Why does it feel like those numbers are just off?
I wonder if the women's magazines are perpetuating that. I don't know the answer.
Yeah.
I know that more men remarry.
Yeah, and remarry more quickly.
And right? remarry more quickly.
Yeah.
You know, there's an old quote. It comes from a poem. It's borrowed from a poem by Ted Hughes. And it's, you know, and I've doctored it a bit, but it's men and women are like 2 feet. They need each other to get ahead. And we are built to work together, play together, love together, live together. And I don't know. I meet an awful lot of single men in New York City. Mm. And they have brains and they have feelings and they do love and they want to be loved. Mm-hmm. And women are the picky sex. Mm. Men fall in love faster than women do because they're so visual. They want more public displays of affection. When they are in love, they want to introduce. sorry. They want to introduce a new partner to friends and family sooner. Huh. They want to move in sooner. Men have more intimate conversations with their wives than women do with their husbands, because women have their intimate conversations with their girlfriends, mm. not their partners. Mm. And men are 2.5 times more likely to kill themselves when a relationship is over. When I ask on the Singles in America study with Match, women are the independent sex. Women are the one that want to go out more often with their girlfriends in the evenings. They want to travel more with girlfriends. They're less willing to share their money. They want more personal time. I think we're just beginning to understand who men are. Hmm. I think we've got this concept that they're sort of bullies who are marching through the room with a bow and arrow. And in fact, in many respects, I think they're the more fragile, yeah. emotionally fragile sex. And deeply willing to, it's women who do all the complaining about their marriages, but women are more verbal.
Yeah.
Women are the custodians of the marriage. Mm. And I think we're just beginning to understand who men really are.
It's really interesting.
Yeah. When you take a look at the brain, and I've put a lot of men into a brain scanner, as I put a lot of women, it lights up exactly the same way when they're in love. And that deep sense of attachment.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the men who will stay in a terrible marriage because they feel so responsible.
Yeah.
And look at all the men dying, for God's sakes, in other countries to protect, thinking they were protecting our country. I mean, men are doers, but they're not talkers about it.
Yeah.
And so we're hearing from women. I remember I was recently with a group of women from the major women's magazines. We were having a business lunch. And there were three women who couldn't find a man. And they were all really good-looking, young, smart, educated, going somewhere women. And none of them could find a man. And I said, you know what? He said, there's no men around. I said, I bet all three of you have at least one man in your life right now who would marry you within a week. But maybe he is the back elevator man for your building. Or maybe it works in the mailroom. You're picky, you know? And the bottom line is, we're picky for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
We're the ones that are going to carry that baby for 9 months. We're the ones that are going to go through the danger of delivering that child. We are the ones who are going to raise that child. Largely, the real day-to-day work for the first 4 years anyway, in every culture in the world. Now, men are changing diapers these days, no question about it. But still, they don't do it the way women do. Women have to be picky.
Mm.
But I think we're going to come to learn that men are just as romantic as women, and that women are just as sexual, and that we're going to cast away these beliefs that men are just fools.
That's really great. This has just been so... I haven't even looked at my notes. Oh, I guess, maybe just one last thing. This is me using this as kind of a therapy
for myself. I'm not a therapist, but I'll do what I can.
Well, just maybe two more questions. So, I'm in my 50s now.
Okay.
And
I'm
as
in my
60s. In your 60s, yeah. And I mean, being in your 50s and 60s is just so interesting.
It's
and in
so
a way
interesting.
That, I mean, it's great.
It is great.
It's a little awkward, though, on this. You know, it's uncertain. I mean, the trajectory of all of this is different. And but one thing that I'm aware of myself is, and as I kind of scrutinize, again, why did my marriage fail? And would I choose better? You know, would I know to choose differently now? And I feel like one of the things that has come with age for me is I look back at my younger self and my love relationships, and I realized how much of it was about wanting to be loved and how much of the exhilaration was about being loved. Mm-hmm. And I want to be more intentional moving forward about like the adventure of loving, you know?
I had an adventure recently that was very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I fell immediately for a person in my business world. I would never touch that guy. He was very important in my business world. He's a happily married guy. Mm-hmm. And there was no way that Helen Fisher was ever going to put a move on him. Never. And I never did. Mm-hmm. And for the first time in my life, I would every time I saw him, my heart would pound. I'd get a dry mouth. I would try to be a normal person. And I realized that I was going to have to enjoy this feeling all by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I would come home and I'd lie down and say, okay, Helen, just enjoy the feeling of, he doesn't know, you never know.
Mm-hmm.
And try to just enjoy the sensation of adoring somebody. From the backwoods, you know,
right.
pew in the church. And it was a different experience for me to not make any kind of move. Because mm-hmm. young girls do that. Mm-hmm. You know, they say,
Or you think that it meant nothing if you couldn't make the move.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, but I do think that what goes around comes around. And if you and I and other people just, you know, spend some time loving somebody. And it's interesting how they respond. I mean, you know, a man and I sort of left each other a couple years ago. And so now I don't have that intense need for him. I can love him in the way he should have been loved all along.
Mm-hmm.
With a deep attachment, a real understanding for who he is, and just giving him the time he needs with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And not being all upset if I don't hear from him. Released from that passion. You can finally love somebody in some new ways that are mm-hmm. Can be very comforting, not only for them but for you.
Yeah,
and then you can build a new kind of partnerships with them.
It just feels like what we're talking about is like this kind of maturation of our collective.
It's too bad I didn't do it sooner.
Yeah, well, that's how it goes. It's maturation, right? I guess just finally, I just wanted to note. I did Lily, my producer, found this blog that you wrote.
Okay.
I don't know if you've written it on it recently, but for a while. And you always signed it Sempre ad Astra, always to the stars,
yes.
After a line of Tennyson. And I just, you know, when I read that, I thought, you know, she's a romantic.
I am.
She's a romantic. And so I wondered, with this life you've lived and this work you've done, you know, how has the meaning of that term and that thing, being a romantic, evolved for you? Can you talk about how it's changed over time?
Being a romantic?
Yeah.
What a great question. Semper ad astra.
Mm.
That is my motto. I didn't know that was from Tennyson. Is it from Tennyson?
I think you said it was from Tennyson.
Oh, no. It's my family motto.
Oh,
I mean,
it is.
It's my family crest. My family apparently goes back to Holland in 1603. And on that family... a crest or a family tree.
Mm-hmm.
It says Semper ad Astra.
Mm.
And I've loved it from that moment to this. And it's what I live. It's where I live is that term. You're going to make me cry, so I got to get my act together. romance. Ask the question again.
How that romantic and, you know, what your sense of what it means to be romantic or your experience of that, you know.
I guess I've just sort of lived it.
You just lived it.
Yeah. I was so impressed yesterday with your interview because I thought to myself, my God, Helen, you're so shallow. I've never thought about my inside and my outside and the Mobius strip. And I never thought about any of that. I'm sort of bebopping along living it.
And so that gave me a good deal of pause. I just am a romantic. It's a pain in the neck. I cry at parades. You know, I look in a baby carriage that's going down this baby going down the street and say, "Oh boy, are you in for some rock and roll?"
Yeah.
I go into museums and I see all the little amulets and the pendants, and I think somebody gave that to somebody 100,000 years ago. There's a love story there. I love poetry because it captures the passion of people around the world. It gives me a great sense of unity with all of humanity that ever was and ever will be.
Hmm. That's great. What fun. Thank you. I don't think you're shallow. You can stop worrying about that.
No, no, no. Thank you.
Yeah. That's an amazing interview.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It was
interview.
Such a great conversation.
Well, because, I mean, it was not standard.
No.
And yet I was able to say all these things. It was just wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Great. It was great for me, too.
Great. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
I might be a little shallow. I mean, I didn't get a lot of what they were talking about yesterday. Don't put this on the tape. I guess a doer. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's the first time I've ever said that I was an atheist. I don't know if that'll go over.
Oh, don't worry about it. I interview a lot of atheists. I mean, it's an interesting question to ask about the spiritual background of people's childhood.
Yeah.
Everybody has one, even an atheist.
Yeah.
And it's often true that, I just feel like it's a, what I hear in the stories people tell is it's a place where a lot of questions got planted that people actually followed, you know? It wasn't necessarily...
I guess my questions weren't planted there.
Yeah.
Because my mother, instead of taking me to church, would get down on her hands and knees and look at the worms and say, "Oh, you see the worms
exactly,
going this way."
Right, right.
And,
but
you
somehow
know,
you associate that. You somehow it is associated with, even in the absence of it or the turning away from it, there are questions that arise, and there's stuff people work with.
Absolutely.
And they continue to work with.
You don't have to be religious to be empathetic.
Yeah.
Or to be a good person.
Yeah.
Or to have profoundly basic and important values.
Yeah. I mean, I've asked, like, people, you know, what was the spiritual background of your childhood? And somebody said, loneliness.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, and seeing that as a spiritual state of being.
Uh-huh.
And you know, somebody else would just say love, and then you get
that's
really
so interesting.
You know, and so I mean, like Robert Coles, who was the great child psychologist, who wrote The Spiritual Life of Children, and before that, he wrote about the political lives of children, and his story was about. So I think his father was Jewish and his mother was Christian or something, and his father would a little bit like your story, but you know. His father would drive them to church every Sunday morning, but he never came in. So he drove them all to church. They went to church. He stayed in the car and read the New York Times. Right. But Robert Coles like got so curious about like, you know, why did his father stay in the car? And like then all this interesting thinking came about in that space of wondering. And
isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, it's very fascinating. It's a really fertile thing to ask people about.
I wonder what would happen if I talked with a theologian. I wonder. I'm not a debater. And I'm one of these people who just wants to keep the peace. So I would search for harmony karma.
No, I thought your response was really great. But we have all kinds of people who listen to our show, including, you know, really devout religious people. And then, you know, lots of atheists and agnostics. So everything in between. But we do have very faithful people. And I was kind of, as we were talking, I was kind of listening for them and thinking,
what will they do with this?
Yeah, and I was kind of feeling their discomfort. So I think what you said was just perfect. It was just beautiful.
See, I don't remember what I said, but it worked okay.
Well, you can listen when it's
fantastic. I will definitely. Yeah. Oh, thank you.